conversations with remarkable working women. And that is certainly what we have today with my friend Louise Story. Louise, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I was just thinking back to how long we've known each other since you
almost 20 years.
How is that possible?
Look, we're still looking great here, so it's all good.
We're still looking great. So let's just jump in. I mean, you have had such a fantastic career to date and a lot more to come, but can we start by just talking a little bit about your career trajectory?
Sure. Thank you. You know, really what's gone on in my career over the last 20 years is I've just been up for stuff. And I think that's what's made my career so fun. And by being up for stuff, I mean, you know, I was working at the New York Times. When I first met you, I was covering advertising. It was a great first beat. And so many people I know around the advertising industry from that time period. But I had said, you know, to the editors, I have my MBA, I know finance. And so the day after Bear Stearns collapsed, the business editor said, we need someone else in the Wall Street group. And me, you know, I'm up for stuff. So I'm like, great, you know, I'm in. And he said, cover Merrill Lynch and cover Lehman Brothers. And, you know, they were gone in 6 months. And as things went along, you know, it would be like, who would like to volunteer to do a 6 a.m. radio segment every day of the week for the next few years in the business section? I'm like, I'm up for it. So then I start doing WNYC in the morning before I went to my job at the New York Times. And so really my career, I've gotten to do so many cool things because when there's something that sounds interesting that I can learn, I just love to jump on it. And then I think people you work with know that. And so that's led to, you know, a vast array of different things from producing, writing a film to running a live video at the New York Times, doing all kinds of investigations, doing strategic reports for the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. And so that's the story of my career.
Well, that's great advice to just be up for and to not look for. So many people are just sort of afraid or they don't want to go through the hassle and, you know, immediately it's almost thinking of why not to do something. And it sounds like that's not how you've lived your life, that you're just, you'll do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I didn't really realize this until, so eventually when I was at the Wall Street Journal, starting in 2018, I was there a few months and a few months in after being one of the top news editors, the chief product and technology officer got promoted to be the deputy CTO of News Corp. So then they said, well, you know, you're technically minded and you're involved with working with some of our technology teams. Would you also like to be the chief product and technology officer? And so I said, yeah, that's great. I'm up for it. I never realized quite that it was unique to be up for stuff until at that juncture, about a month in, I had a woman on the engineering team come to me and say, I never thought I'd have a female as a CTO at a company I worked at. And in fact, I am the first female chief technology officer at a major media brand. And she said, you know, how did you feel like you could say yes when you weren't an engineer? Like, didn't you hesitate? And I realized I didn't. And it's made me think since then, and I'm now a mother of three children and I do have a daughter. It's made me think, what is it that I've just always thought, yes, I can do it. I'm up for it. And I say yes. And I've not questioned that. And some people do. And how can I instill not only in my children, but in also people I mentor and teams I support, that confidence in people that, you know, believe in yourself and say, yes, I'm up for it and go do it.
Well, let me ask you a quick question then, because sometimes in terms of believing in yourself, somebody will ask someone, you know, on their team to do something or you'll have an opportunity, someone will have an opportunity and they'll think, I don't know if I'm really qualified for that. Do you just push past that and say, I'm up for it?
That's exactly it. So that's what that engineer was essentially saying to me was, well, did you wonder if you would be able to do the job? And she said it with a lot of admiration that I had jumped on the opportunity. And I realized I never have that thought. And for me to understand how many people actually do have that thought and hold themselves back was a really powerful thing and has helped me think about how can I help more people say, yes, I'm up for it, because it really can help people, I think, have more interesting careers, and it can help organizations nurture talent in different ways.
That's such a good point. So throughout your career, besides having the perfect last name for what you do, is there one thing that has driven you or a thread that has helped you make the choices that you make and have made?
Yes, there are a couple things that I've realized over time were important to me, even as a child growing up. Because I grew up doing theater, and I was always doing theater until I got into journalism in college. And I've come to understand that it's fascinated me from the get-go to try to understand other people's perspectives. And so that's why I so enjoyed being in theater, because, you know, when you are an actor and you play someone else, you really get inside of them. And as a journalist, it's the same thing. You have to really listen and understand different perspectives. And so one of the things that's really motivated me through so much of my work has been, what can I do to lift up a variety of voices? And in particular, what can I do to lift up voices that might not otherwise be heard? And I find that really powerful when I can do a story and I can share information, or I can support teams doing that, where the information and those perspectives might not have come out otherwise.
See, now I know why we like each other so much, because I was a theater major too. And I always think, and I always tell the people that I work with, as a PR person, when you're pitching a story, of course, you know what you want to gain from it. You want the story, but you have to look and think from the other person's perspective, from the editor, from the reporter, what is it that they're trying to gain? Mm-hmm. And let's try to tailor a pitch to them in that way. And that's the same thing. So it makes so much sense to think of it from that way, and you're already ahead. And that really goes for so many different things, way past journalism.
Yeah. And of course, in the news industry, a big role that I've played at the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, and then I do in a lot of my consulting now, is helping news organizations think more about their readers and their viewers. And so that's the same turn on it. You know, okay, editor, you have the story you might want to tell, but what is the audience interested in? So you have to, you know, push on that there too.
So in terms of lifting up voices, sharing voices, for people that might not be heard, I feel like that's a perfect segue into your new book, 15 Cents on the Dollar, How Americans Made the Black-White Wealth Gap. First off, how did it come into being, this book?
Sure. I have it right here. Keep it by my desk. I was running all the news coverage strategy at the Wall Street Journal in the summer of 2020. And so I was very much grappling in real time with decisions like, you know, okay, company X today announced a corporate pledge that they're going to do this or that. And then another, you know, how much are we going to cover that? Are these things real? Are they going to change anything? And discussions about the demonstrations that were happening around the country, how to cover them, and even words we were using to describe things. And so doing that in my job, it also was a time we were in the pandemic and we were shut in our homes. And while I was doing that from a coverage standpoint, I was running a really huge team. And there were a lot of questions also from team members in every company about issues of equity and race and workplaces. And so I started having conversations with a lot of people about things at work, but also sometimes the conversations turned a little bit personal. And there was a woman on my team at the Wall Street Journal named Ebony Reed. And there were a few conversations we had where we started talking a little bit more about our life, where we grew up and our fathers and similarities, but also differences. And there were a few things that she shared with me that I realized were different for her because of race. And it was really eye-opening for me. She's a very talented professional person in journalism in a similar place in her career to me. And you would say similarly making a similar income. But when we started talking about wealth and the kind of money and family access to things we had and choices our parents had made and things that we faced, I understood, you know, for example, one juncture, we talked about both of our fathers, both were first in their family to go to college. But her father made career decisions along the way, sometimes that, you know, maybe didn't propel his career as fast, to move their family to different areas that would be safer and more friendly to Black Americans. And that's not something my father ever had to think about, you know, a neighborhood potentially being hostile to our family moving there as he advanced in his career. And so we, in those conversations, we started talking and we realized there is no book on the Black-White wealth gap all through history. It didn't exist. And so we decided we were the perfect pair to write it. You know, I have a long time reputation as a financial editor and writer. I covered the Wall Street and the financial crisis. And Ebony has covered a lot of community journalism. For example, she was in Detroit in 2008 during the financial crisis and covering the foreclosures. And so we thought we were the perfect pair. The book should exist. And so we spent the past 3 years doing it and it came out really well. And I think people can learn a lot from it.
That's amazing. Well, in terms of learning a lot from it, let's start with, what does the title actually mean? What does 15 cents on the dollar mean?
Thank you for asking, because we are on a mission to make 15 cents on the dollar a nationally recognized statistic. And I know so many people who will watch this from your circles also are thoughtful about how to spread the message on things. So I welcome anyone to DM me with ideas on how to make the statistic nationally recognized. 15 cents on the dollar is the Black-White wealth gap. The typical Black family in America has 15 cents in wealth compared to $1 held in wealth by the typical white family. And we have data in the book going all the way back to the 1860s that covers how this gap has changed. And it started at 1.8 cents in the dollar after the Civil War. And then it went up and it eventually got up to 15 cents in the dollar in the 1950s. And then it kept going up and it got to 22 cents in the dollar in the early 1990s. And then it's been moving around, but now it's at 15 cents in the dollar. And as I said before, that's where it was in the 1950s. And so a lot of Americans don't know this. And we think if people knew this data, it would help inform conversations that people are having on all kinds of topics, from education to banking to real estate to workforce policies.
So what's contributed? I mean, obviously, there are certain things that initially come to mind, but what's contributed to the horrifyingly expanding gap?
So there's many things. That's why our book is 460 pages. And it's like peeling back an onion. You just keep peeling and peeling and you're like, you know. But some of the big things would be, of course, you know, one thing is generational wealth. You know, just when there's a lot of money in the hands of certain groups of people, it stays there. And it's not just what's passed out when someone passes away. People also pass money to their children through their children's entire life. You know, whether your parents have money determines whether you have student debt, for example. And a lot of people get helped in a home down payment by their parents. And so one big thing is just that, what's happening with this generational wealth. But other things include, for example, you know, the delay with which Black Americans could attend a lot of the same educational institutions as white Americans. It's really not that long ago. You know, even my father, when he went to medical school at Emory Medical School, it was kind of eye-opening to me to realize only a few years before he went, Emory Medical School admitted its first Black student. So my father was the first in this community to college. He worked really hard. In many ways, he was self-made. But if he had been 5 years older and Black, he couldn't have gone to the medical school that he went to. And so that's my father. So we're not talking like 100 years ago. So delay in education, things like, for example, the GI Bill and many other policies from that era were not equally available to Black and white Americans when the white middle class was being built. But even things more recent, you know, we write about the 2008 economic and housing crisis and how that affected different groups of people differently. And we write about the bankruptcy system today and how that affects white Americans versus Black Americans. So there's a lot of factors. Another major one has been student debt in the last 40 years. The average Black family has $25,000 more in student debt than the average white family. And another major one has been the stock market boom of the last 30, 40 years, because the Black families that did have wealth to invest starting in the 80s and 90s, they disproportionately invested in housing compared to white families who had comparable wealth to invest. And so Black families did not benefit as much from the stock market increase just due to investing choices that went on.
So what are some of the things, and I'm sure, you know, you have to read Louise and Ebony's book to hear it all, but what are some of the things that can be done to fix it?
Well, one thing we were really purposeful about is we did not take any political positions. We don't make any policy recommendations because, you know, as journalists, we're just trying to give the data, the facts, and tell stories so people can relate to it. So a lot of our book is the story of seven different people we found to be very compelling and learning about their lives and kind of getting an inside glimpse of their money, which is kind of rare because people don't really talk openly about wealth. And I think that's what will keep you turning the pages, like trying to understand this the finances of people and their histories of their families with money. So we don't give a policy recommendation, but we do in the afterword, we give a few personal recommendations. And they're things that we think people can do in their own life that are attainable. And that if a lot of people did these things, it would have an impact, right? So one thing, of course, is we're hoping people will spread word of 15 cents on the dollar, because research shows that about 40% of Americans, including Black Americans, think the Black-White wealth gap is gone. So just having more people be aware of the fact that it's here and it's large will affect conversations. Another thing that we recommend is if everyone could find a way in their life, a meaningful project where they have money on the line, time on the line, their reputation on the line, where you partner in a meaningful partnership, not hire someone, but like really try to work equally with someone who's had a very different life from you. And in this case, someone across a different racial group, you can learn a lot. And Ebony and I did this for this book. And we learned not only through our interviews and our look at the data and our historical research, but we also learned in navigating our partnership because we were working really hard to make it as equitable as possible, but we have different life situations. And what we really learned over time is that making something equitable is not necessarily expecting identical things from each other. And a lot of times when people talk about opportunity and equal opportunity, you expect people to all put up the same thing, but people are coming in with different budgets, different time available, different resources, different networks. And so that give and take that we worked out so that we could both be equal partners, but not expect the same things necessarily, really taught us a lot about the give and take that, you know, more communities could benefit from.
So let's talk just quickly now, move on from your book to, you mentioned before about your work as a consultant, a media and technology consultant. What does that entail?
Sure. So since I left the Wall Street Journal, which I left 3 years ago to write this book because my job at the Wall Street Journal was incompatible with doing an ambitious book. I was really like, had two jobs at the journal, really, with the chief technology and product officer, as well as a top news editor. So since I left, I have been consistently consulting for news companies. And, you know, really, I actually haven't looked for work. It's kind of come my way. So I feel really lucky. I didn't know I was even going to consult when I left the journal. I thought I was going to write the book, but interesting stuff has come up. And what I've mainly been asked to do are a few different things. One thing is projects that cross across the media business, because I am a content expert and have done, you know, a lot of editorial leadership, but I've also been a chief technology officer. And though I was not an engineer when I came in, I oversaw significant technology teams, products, changes in our tech stack at the Wall Street Journal. And I know quite a lot about it at this point. And so usually what I've been doing these projects is a news company looking for growth in its audience or often in its subscribers will ask me to work with them on a strategy where the strategy has tentacles in technology, in marketing, in content, and in advertising, which I also know about, so that the strategy is coherent across the business. And because I've worked in all those spaces and know all those spaces, I'm able to help make a cross-company strategy. So that's been the main thing I've done. I've also worked on several acquisitions, essentially vetting the state of different teams. Again, because I know all these areas, I can go in and say, okay, this team has this strength, this one's a little weak. And then the other thing that's come up has been AI and news, because actually at the Wall Street Journal, starting in 2018, we did early AI deployment. Quite a lot of really interesting AI projects that we did, and early language models that we built or partnered with tech companies to build. And so drawing on that, I've advised several news companies on everything from their AI strategy to one of them worked on actually building an LLM. Another one was acquiring a company in the AI space. And so, you know, just having the knowledge of both how content works and also how AI and ML work has been helpful at this moment.
Well, that feels like an entirely other conversation on AI, because you can't really have a conversation now around so many different issues and not talk about it. But I just have to ask you, I mean, AI and journalism, it feels like it could potentially be a very dangerous combination.
Well, what's really dangerous on the internet right now is something that's already happening and has been happening even before AI, which is, you know, misleading information and fake information. And AI already is and will likely continue to increase the volume of fake information. So AI is a tool that can be used to do that. But again, it's something that was happening before, and it's people doing that using AI. I think that, you know, if news companies navigate this in a smart way and figure out ways to really show the audiences the trustworthiness in what they do, which I think some news companies need to change what they're doing a little bit more to show more the provenance of their information, because news companies aren't always universally trusted at the moment. But if they can show the provenance of their information, then, you know, this is something that can set news companies, you know, even more apart strategically going forward. But yeah, AI like can definitely confuse a lot of people about what's real, what's not real. There could be some good things. I think one thing that could be good from AI for the news industry, if the news industry is thoughtful on this, is that, you know, in all industries, AI can free up time. It's not just the news industry. Like in every industry, AI is going to free up time. The news industry, you know, is an industry with, you know, revenues and profits have not been so high for most companies. So freeing up time can be a good thing, so that reporters can spend more time in depth investigating things, looking for things. I also think news companies should think about the fact that over the last 20 years, far fewer reporters go in person to anything. And I think that has contributed to some of the lack of trust in journalism across the country, because when people are not as likely to see a reporter out an event, out around their community, like showing up and covering things, they just don't know journalists. And that, again, leads to a lack of trust. So I think as AI frees up resources, news companies could think about, you know, how to put reporters back out in the field, how to focus reporters on what so many journalists got in the business to do, which is in-depth reporting, uncovering new information.
Which is what we need now, like real information, right?
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
There's no question about that. So if people want to read your book and they want to follow you, how do they find you?
Well, the book has a website. It's 15cents.info, like 15. 15cents.info. So everything about the book is on that website. And I'm pretty easy to find, you know, on LinkedIn or Twitter. And I love to hear from people. So if anyone wants to DM me on those platforms, I'll be responsive. And so I'll watch out for stuff.
Perfect. And in the meantime, is there one piece of advice that has really helped you guide you through your life and career that you can please share with us?
That's tough, because I do feel like as I've gone through my career, I keep learning new things. I don't feel like I was so wise when I was 18 that, you know, my best piece of advice is still necessarily driving me forward right now. I've realized a lot of flawed thinking I used to have. But, you know, I'll just share my father, who passed away a few years ago. One of the things that he would often say and also illustrate in his own life was the idea of rising above. And especially with him passing away a few years ago, I've really tried to think about that, which is just the idea of, you know, don't let things get to you that you might not like and affect how you behave on things, right? Just rise above that. And really reminding myself of that really allows me to keep perspective and not let little things bother me. And I think that's a really, really good thing. And I probably didn't have that straight when I was 18.
Well, you have it now, and it's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. And thank you for talking with us. It was wonderful to reconnect.
Thank you, Katie.